Hey, everybody, in this episode of I Talk Movies, we're getting up close and personal with actor Adam Hirschman and writer-director Rick Darsh. Let's do it.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's I Talk Movies.
Hey, everybody. Cat Stevens bringing us in to this episode of I Talk Movies. This is the show where we talk to the people both in front and behind the camera to bring you all that great entertainment you get to see in the movie theaters, at home, or maybe on your mobile streaming device. I'm your host, Frank Moran. Now, my guests today are two parts of the film that explores the concept of lucid dreaming, Zen Dog. Now, what wasn't a dream, though, is that the film actually uses the recordings of British philosopher Alan Watts, and if that wasn't cool enough, the film also won the Film of the Festival at the Raindance Film Festival. Zendog was just released on video on demand, Blu-ray, and all digital platforms. So please, ladies and gentlemen, welcome actor Adam Hirschman and writer and director of Zendog, Rick Darsh.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here. Thank you, Frank.
So Cat Stevens bringing us in for this.
Yeah.
I used this in the film, as you mentioned.
Yes.
What was it about Cat Stevens that kind of just resonated with what you wanted to accomplish with the film?
The movie was always kind of this homage to the films of the 60s and 70s. I really like the modernist era filmmaking where they would experiment. I thought the way they made Easy Rider was very inspiring. They gave these guys, you know, a bit of money, and, you know, Dennis Hopper went out there with Peter Fonda, and they were, you know, making things happen with what they had to use, and there was a looseness about it. And Cat Stevens is very much a part of that era, and I was always a fan of Harold and Maude, which was a film that stars Bud Cort, made back in the day. And I just enjoyed how just Cat Stevens' lyrics and what he has to say, specifically this song with Sitting, I felt that it was very appropriate for our character and his journey to what he needed to do in order to move on without giving too much. I don't want to give the film away, but there was just something that resonated with me with that song, and it was difficult to get it because we're a little indie production, and Cat Stevens is a giant name, but it took a bit of persistence, and we were able to secure the rights and get it, make it a part of Zendog. So.
When you want to get somebody like a Cat Stevens song involved, what are the hoops that you do have to go through that kind of show like, hey, we may be a small independent film, but really, this is a project that's worth your time and involvement.
Yeah, the main...
I wrote him like 6 or 7 letters.
Oh, Adam, how nice.
Of which 0 were returned.
Yeah.
But he knew then that it was a good project.
Adam was really persistent. We had Adam show up at his front doorstep and...
And his back doorstep. He has a stoop, actually. It's a really nice stoop.
Just sat on that stoop and just had him waiting you out.
I sat on that stoop and then they called the cops. But anyways...
I wish we did that. It's actually really boring. You get a really talented music supervisor. In this case, we had a woman named Liz Lawson, who's done a number of films. She contacted me out of the blue. She saw the Kickstarter that we originally did to raise money for Zendog. The initial raising of money, and she extended her services, and she would send me lists of songs that she thought would work well in the movie. And one of the songs she sent me was this amazing composition work by this guy named William Ryan Fritch, and I loved it. And she said, he's unsigned, he's an independent artist, and I think we can get him. And we contacted him, sent him the film, and he scored the entire movie. Cat Stevens was a song. I wanted one song in the film, and that was something that I wanted to use. And she told me right away, I wouldn't count on it. It's going to be really difficult. His people are hard. They don't just willy-nilly give out rights to indie films, let alone big commercial films. But I said, no, let's just try. Like, so I remember thinking, like, I don't want to accept no. Let's have them say no first before you're telling me no. And she just continued to pursue them. It took 12 months, and they wanted a lot of money. And at first they said no, then they wanted a lot of money, and then they agreed to do it for a reasonable rate that worked within our budget. And I was so happy, because it's without that song, I don't know, it would feel different to me. They like needed that song in the film.
I have the same negotiating tactics as Cat Stevens. I say no, then I'm like, well, I only will do it for a lot of money, and then I'll just do it for nothing.
Yeah. You're not supposed to tell them.
Similar.
Now you told everybody your secret.
Yeah, I know. Now it's out there.
Now we know how to get Adam. Filmmakers, I hope you're watching. You're going to be able to scoop up Adam.
No means yes, is what I'm trying to say when it comes to projects.
Only projects.
So, Rick, as the 12 months is going on, and you're like, hey, is this going to get approval go through? Do you just have to start thinking of like, well, if that song falls through,
yeah,
I have to start pursuing backup options?
Yeah, the composer, William, made a backup option. He made a a ending credit song that would work for the film, which I actually ended up needing and using because our credits are so long. We had so many Kickstarter backers that when it comes to the special thanks, you're spending 2 minutes to watch all those names because we promised that we'd put those names in. And I mean, we without the Kickstarter backers, there would be no movie. They really gave us the propulsion to get started. But yeah, there's like periods of doubt and wondering, well, if I don't get this, what can I use? And to me, it was, well, let's just use another original score piece rather than it was either that song or score. There wasn't going to be another song that would come in. That song Sitting, I used to play all the time when I was writing the film. So it was really like magical and important for me. And it was amazing that we were able to get it and that it exists in the film today.
That's right. And, yeah. Because I have to imagine for you to not be able to use that would just be, you'll do it, but it would just take away something that had been just so part of the creative process and building it.
Yeah, film. But I would have, I know that if they said no, I would have accepted that and adapted and would have been able to make it work and would be talking to you today about how I'm happy with it. Because like as a filmmaker, you can't finish, you're never going to get exactly what you want. Otherwise you're going to get Star Wars Episode One, you know, if you have too much money. So I think there's something to be said about having constraints and having, dealing with issues and not getting what is in your mind, because then the film will deliver to you what you should be getting. So if that makes sense. But yeah, there was a lot of moments of learning how to deal with stress and deal with things that weren't working and know that, well, as long as we know that the film is going to be complete, things will kind of manifest the way they're supposed to. So
was Star Wars 1, was that the Lucas, was that after the first three?
Yeah, that was when.
Okay. I just want to make sure it wasn't like one you meant his first.
No, that's
like you were going Episode 1.
Phantom Menace.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that for the
listeners. Episode 1. Which is like, it's a fun movie, but you know, he had a lot of money, so you kind of can do whatever.
Right, you can.
And I think if we could do everything on Zendog, it'd be, I don't know, it'd be much different.
It'd be spaceships and yeah,
that's right. Amazing.
Yeah, so yeah.
Well, I know there's an author, Neil Gaiman, who did like Sandman, Good Omens, things mm-hmm. like that, a few other things.
All right.
But he was saying, if you just tell him to write any story that you want, he'll just sit there and he will be stymied. But
yeah.
If you give him constrictions
sure. yeah.
and a box to work in, then he can do
get
something.
Creative, yeah. yeah. And that's what filmmaking is. I mean, at the end of the day, you're dealing with light, you're dealing with, especially on location shooting, you're dealing with the sun and you only have so many hours in the day and you're dealing with takes and angles and you can only get so many takes because you have to get this coverage now. And then you start making choices in the moment. Okay, like I wanted to shoot this with three different angles, but now I can't, so I have to do it in one angle. How can I condense and get to the most important thing? So you end up like with a better film, I think, because of these conditions. If you had all the time in the world, I think you would have that perfectionist mind of like it's never going to be good enough and then you're never gonna get anything done. So
now you had aspirations to be a director from a young age.
Yes.
But Adam, how about you? Was acting always something that was part of the game plan, or when did acting kind of become something that you really wanted to pursue?
It was always something that I didn't do it growing up. I wasn't acting. I wasn't in plays or you know, musical. I wasn't doing a lot of theater. I mean, I took some drama classes and had a good drama instructor, which is like part of the program at my school. But it wasn't something I really thought was realistic. I'm from Minneapolis, and it wasn't something where there were a lot of people in the entertainment business back there. So it wasn't until I moved out here and I had a job, and it was something that I started taking classes. And after a couple of years of doing that, I decided to give it a chance. So I was kind of failing at everything else. And then was like, oh, and I was young, not knowing a ton of stuff. So I was like, I'll give it a shot. And then just kind of got a couple lucky breaks and here today.
So when you moved out here from Minneapolis, was it with the intention of getting involved in the entertainment business and being
not really, not like at the forefront. I mean, it was always in the back of my mind, like, I love comedy, but like, where, I don't know, if, you know, how do you do that? Like, I didn't know how to do that. And then you start realizing, I started taking improv classes. I took classes at the Groundlings. I took just several acting classes and started building my confidence and my chops. And then someone said, go get your headshots. You should get your headshots taken. And I was like, yeah, okay. And then I did. And I mailed them all out there in the world and got all these rejection letters. One place was like, we like your headshot, but you have no resume, nothing. They're like, but come meet with us. And then ended up booking a commercial through them, and I'm still actually with them today. So
Oh, cool. Well, if they're going to give you a shot, it's always like you stay loyal to the people who
I think that's important. I think that gets lost in entertainment. But
loyalty?
A little. Well, I just think, maybe in life. Yeah. But so that it wasn't something that wasn't like planned, but it was something that like put myself in a situation to get out there and do that. And, did student films, just would do anything I could to get my, get experience. I went on game shows just to get in front of the camera.
What game shows?
I was on Russian Roulette, which is a show.
I've not heard of that one.
Russian Roulette was on the Game Show Network. You fall through the floor when you get something wrong. And I got all my answers right. And I was like, I'm going to win. This is going to be the greatest time of my life. And there was a huge audience. And then all of a sudden, this girl, she was leading. I didn't get anything wrong, but she got to press the button and it went around the circle and it landed on me and I fell through the floor. I was like, out.
Oh, man.
It was a super bummer. And I was on a show called Beat the Geeks. I don't know if you remember that show.
Yeah.
I was on that. And it was just to get in front of the camera, like whatever I could to get in front of the camera or do something. That's what I was trying to do to do that. And then, not being a perfectionist about it, just getting experience.
So when you tell your family, hey, you know what? I'm leaving Minneapolis. I'm heading west. Are they like, Adam, yes, do it.
They were supportive, and then when I started decided like, oh, maybe I'm going to give this a chance, they're like, I don't know. They were like, it wasn't like, oh, you're going to do great. It was kind of like, we don't know what that is. I remember getting a booked a commercial for like, I don't know what it was, some company, maybe it was AT&T or Verizon, and I was talking to my grandma, and she was like, oh, I'm so proud of you. This is so great. She goes, but maybe you could ask them to get a job. I'm like, I don't think it works that way. I don't think they're going to give me a job at their company. I was just in a commercial for them. It's so different. Mm-hmm. She's like, yeah, it's really great, but maybe you should ask them if they have like any 9 to 5.
A 9 to 5. Yes.
And I was like, I don't think you guys understand like that. So like literally, I was just like, I couldn't make anyone happy.
That's like why I'm doing this. So I don't have.
Yeah. I was like, yeah, exactly. But it's like that, that's just kind of like, if you don't live in a city where they have this type of stuff, LA or New York, especially, you're kind of, you don't really know how it works. And you just don't know.
What was the first thing that they saw that you were in? They're like, oh, now we get it.
It was a commercial. I think they saw me in a commercial. I can't remember exactly which one it was. I mean, I've done a lot of commercial work. But it was a commercial, and I think, they thought that was really, really cool. And, it was kind of like, oh, we knew you could do it.
Yeah.
We knew you could do it. I'm so sorry. We knew you could do it. So that was cool. And then just some movies and whatever else I've done. They've just been very supportive. And it's being in this field, it's a lot of ups and downs because it's not usually it's not consistent. It's only consistent work for very few people. But you just got to just stay in it. So there's a lot of ups and downs. They've been, luckily they've been very supportive and positive. So that's what you need.
Now, Rick, I would mention, just reading a little bit about you. As I mentioned, I had aspirations for directing at a young age. Mm-hmm. So kind of like almost like a Steven Spielberg. You get your friends around, you get a camera, you start shooting them and stuff. Was that just always the end goal? There was no other route? It was like, nope, it's directing or bust.
I wanted to do like animation and cartooning when I was really young. My uncle's an artist. My mom's a photographer. My dad is in the videography. And there's always been the creative arts around the house. And I didn't want to pursue animation anymore because it was just too tedious. And I remember seeing someone's drawing in middle school. Like it was some drawing contest and they put the winning drawing up in the window of the classroom. And I remember thinking like, wow, that's a really good drawing. Like I'm never going to be that good. I don't want to do this anymore. And, but filmmaking spoke to me because my grandpa
had Brad Bird.
Yeah, it was Brad. Exactly. I used to go to my sister and I would go, my brothers and sisters, we would go to our grandparents' place for the summer in Florida for like 2 to 3 months. We'd spend the whole summer there back when we were kids. And around 12 or 13, my grandpa had a Video 8 camera and I just would start making shorts with the brother and sisters. And I would go back, I've listened to those tapes and I was like a tyrant, like just yelling at them to like do what I need. It was a terrible, terrible brother, but they would, that was, the beginning of it.
Adam, did that style still exist on Zendog? Was he just a tyrant?
No.
I mean, he was more like an oligarch, where it's just like, he's just like, he just like I don't know. He just drank a lot of vodka.
Do this.
It was always just a dream of mine to go in and make movies and make content. And, I've always wanted to make movies. And then now we're in this golden period of episodic television. And there's, TV has changed so much. I feel like in some ways TV is, more accessible now for people. And that's how they're kind of consuming ideas and things. And there's still a place for films. But I just it just feels like everything is merging right now. I mean, the films on VOD, theatrical releases are a lot different than they were, for independence 10, 15 years ago. So it's everything is changing. And I love making stuff. And I was always kind of afraid of it in my early 20s, like finding the right project to invest my time in and write and direct. So I kind of bounced around between DPing projects, doing cinematography, editing projects, kind of working more in those positions, collaborating with other directors and producers before I kind of got the courage to I'm going to do my own thing and it's going to be Zendog. So
was it just a question of you felt like you were being too precious?
I was being too precious, and I wasn't there wasn't an idea that attached to my heart in the same way Zendog did, to where, I mean, when I set out to make the film, I remember there was a definite attitude shift within me where it was like, okay, if you want to make a movie and you want it to, be everything you want it to be, you have to walk into this with a very do or die attitude. It's got to be, or go bust, the same thing. Like, you're going to make the movie or you're going to be dead. Like, that kind of a thing. Like, you're either going to do this or you're going to be an old man and you're going to regret never doing it and want to kill yourself, when you're older. And I remember, having that vision of the future of this is my life, this is my dream, I can't be afraid about or being precious on the idea. And I just it was more of just a decision to go forward than it was idea. I love this idea. It was more just I love the idea of this is going to happen. And then things just started falling into place. And
well, certainly for a writer and a director, but also for an actor, signing on to a project or agreeing this is what project I want to take on, that is a large chunk of your life that you're giving up to this. So you've got to have that.
You don't think about it when you're in it. Like, when you're in it and you're making it and you're doing the Kickstarter, we're thinking we're going to be done in a year, year and a half, 2 years tops, not five and a half, 6 years later. But yeah, you, in hindsight now, yeah, it's definitely, it better be something that you you can't think about making a movie in terms of the end effect. I want people to see it, or money, or whatever. It's got to be I want to make this thing because it has to get made. I don't care so much about the effect of what's going to happen. It's just more the act of doing it. I mean, I think that's the attitude you have to have when you're making it. At least that's what I had to have in order to make it. Otherwise, you run the risk of putting something down or thinking it's not worth it, and then you're just on to the next thing, and then you never complete a project, or there's that too. I've worked on a couple of projects coming out of film school where they were features that, they were supposed to be 4 weeks long, and then you would shoot 5-6 days in, and then the whole thing would be done. No more call sheets. The movie was over. It's sad. You would just see this thing dissolve. And there was moments on Zendog at the very beginning where I thought things were going to dissolve, because it was very stressful shooting this movie on the road, managing people, managing actors, bringing people, flying people in and out of cities to be in certain scenes. And it was tough, but we got through it.
Well, we'll dive into that in just a second, but I have one question, because you're saying it would turn out to be a couple of years, turns out to be five.
Mm-hmm.
So is that your main focus during those 5 years, or are you also taking time off to do other little small projects?
Oh, yeah, you have to, to survive, especially with an independent film, because, money you get from an independent film is coming after it's out there and where it is now. You're going broke making a movie. It's very expensive. So yeah, I would have to do other projects on the side, where I was directing commercial work, music videos, shooting. I still DP occasionally. It was funny because Zendog is somewhat of a serious film, deals with these philosophical issues. And while we were in post on Zendog, and it took so many years to kind of go through the post-finishing, I started diverting my energy into more comedic. It's weird. I started doing improv comedy like Adam was doing and started performing more. And I was doing this because it was like, when the heck is this movie going to come out? What has happened? Because you can't do everything yourself. You give your film away to different companies to do the sound design and color. And when you don't have a lot of money, it takes a lot of time. And there are moments where everyone's asking you, when's your movie coming out? I want to see it. And you're like, I don't know. I'm going to go work on these dumb comedy videos until it does come out. But, you know.
Well, Adam, how's it for you when this project goes from 2 years to, say, five? As an actor, where are you? How's it work for you in terms of working on this, but then also booking other projects as well? And hopefully the schedules coordinate where you're able to be there when Rick needs you.
I was just glad I'm alive to see it. Because, I mean, after 5 years, it's like, I didn't even realize it was 5 years. I just knew it was a while. I'm really bad with time, I guess.
Yeah, it was 5 years in October.
Yeah, I can't believe it. Doesn't feel like 5 years. Yeah.
This interview has gone 2 years so far.
Oh, yeah, this interview will come out in 10 years, right?
That's
right.
Dude, I have stuff at the cleaners from like 6 months ago. Like, I have no my concept of time. I got to get it. That sweater I need. I was going to wear it today, and I didn't. I forgot I was at the cleaners. But no, so like, you know, what's nice, and the other actor, Kyle Gellner, one of the other actors who's in it and amazing in it, said, like, what was so great about the fact that it took so long is it all bonded us on this, like, journey where it was, like, it hadn't come out, so it's still kind of, like, it's still going on, and you kind of feel like you're still involved in it somehow, and what's going on, and what's the update?
Yeah, we had, like, this secret that we all, like, would share. It was the movie. Like, no one else could see it yet because it wasn't ready, so it did bring us all together of, like, this is our thing, and you guys will get it when it's right. Now it's like, oh, it's gone. Like, we don't have
it. Yeah, it's kind of sad that it's like, I mean, I'm happy it's out there, but it's like kind of sad for us because it's like, that was the thing that was like bonding this relationship was this like secret.
Yeah. What are you saying? Yeah, we're never going to talk to each other.
Usually, farewell interview right here.
Usually when you work on a project and the minute the project's over, everyone goes their own directions. They go on the new set. They meet new people.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just... that's what was nice about this is that we've developed our relationships just through this and getting updates every several months of what's going on. Oh, I got post-production. Oh, I found an amazing person to score the movie and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, and then when we did Blu-ray commentary a couple months ago, that was fun to kind of all get back together and, like, watch the movie again and go through it. Our Blu-ray is really awesome. We have all these, like, bonus features, and we have an amazing 27-minute documentary that's on the Blu-ray. We had this incredible filmmaker named Liam Underwood who flew out from Australia, and he was on the bus with us as we went cross-country to shoot the movie, and he just got these intimate moments where we would be... in the moment, like, you know, 15 hours, no sleep, directing a scene, doing something, and Liam would just be parked in the corner, and he would ask you a question when you were stressed out, like, what are you going through right now? And you would tell him, and I would forget about it, because we haven't looked at the footage, so when we got to go through 50-plus hours of raw footage, we got to see all these intimate moments of, I think it's fascinating, and I'm not just saying that because it's my movie, but I think if you're into film and you're into this movie, or you just like movies in general, it's one of the most unique, like, little 27-minute looks into how an indie film gets made, especially on the road, because we're out there literally dealing with strangers jumping in front of our camera in Reno because they're too drunk to think otherwise.
But... yeah, I would say this is one of the most pure and truthful filmmaking experiences I've ever had, because it was just like, you think of like why Sundance came to be and like what was the purpose of Sundance and what was the purpose of independent films. And it's like, it's kind of not what that is anymore. Now it's like big stars in movies called, you know, independent films, but there's huge, huge, you know, money involved with it. And Zendog was just like a dream that Rick had, a story he wanted to tell, and he just did it himself. I mean, there's a lot of people involved, but it was like, I want to do this, and then recruited this amazing cast and crew along the way. And it took quite a while to do it, but he did it. And it was just a true independent filmmaking experience where not everything was planned, you know, not everything went a certain way. And it was kind of like, when you think about it, so if you're a true fan of cinema and film, like especially with the bonus features, you really get to experience, hey, I've always wanted to make a movie, or I have this idea, what's it going to be like? I think you can get a lot out of it from watching that.
Yeah, because I think there's like a level of fear. I mean, I had it, and I think with any filmmaker, where you're like, I don't know how to do it. I have an idea, but I don't know where the money's going to come from. I don't know how I'm going to get a camera. I don't know how I'm going to get a crew. But the craziest thing about it is like the moment you genuinely make that switch inside of yourself to say, this is what I'm going to do with my life for however long it takes. Like, life honestly will deliver you what you need. I don't know how it works, but like things will just start coming to you, and that thing that you needed. I mean, I'm not saying it's easy, but it does happen with your focus. I really feel like you pull it in. And like, I didn't know how we were going to get money raised. I didn't know how we were going to get anything. And I didn't know how I was going to get actors. And I didn't even know Adam. Adam came to me through Kyle Gellner. We needed, and Adam's part was very small in the beginning of the film. He was just going to play Kyle's coworker in a small scene, and we ended up rewriting and changing a lot of stuff. And I thought Adam was so funny, and his personality and his chemistry with Kyle worked so well. And I knew we needed like that comedic kind of lightness to it, and Adam brought it, and we wrote more scenes for you and brought him back in and kind of expanded, definitely expanded his role and made it another thing. But
so the scene that we see when he first starts, when Mud starts drinking the herbal juice,
yes,
that Dwayne kind of hooks him up on. Oh, and we see that scene in San Francisco coming out of the office. Was that originally when the original idea that he was just gonna, that Dwayne was just going to be a coworker?
Yes, it was, and that was part of it. And then it worked in that context of like the dream sequence of him coming out, because he was the guy that introduces him to the tea tonic, and he's there. But yeah, he was just a that scene actually outside of San Francisco. That was the first scene we ever shot in Zendog. We left L.A. in a charter bus that our DP producer Richie Trimble reconverted into a production RV. You can see all the stuff on the behind the scenes. It's incredible. And we had a charter bus with 10 plus people. We had a truck that was towing the 1969 Squareback picture car. And we drove, we left at 6:30, 7 in the morning from LA, got to San Francisco around 2 p.m., unloaded, and we're shooting that scene at 4:30. And then we're going to bed to wake up at 6 a.m. the next day. That was our first day. So the first day out the gate, people were like, what is going on? This is the movie? Like, it was just go, go, go. And this
catering in the parking lot.
Yeah, catering in the parking. My mom cooked for us the whole time. She was on the bus with us, like, preparing homemade lasagna and pasta dishes. And
from scratch.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's going to be a little taking a little bit of home with you. So
yeah.
In terms of making this, like, all right, I got a little comfort with me.
Yeah. Definitely. My mom at first, she wanted to come. She's like, I want to help. And I'm like, no, I got this. I'm going to do this movie myself. I don't want mom there. I got to make it myself. And then as I was driving, she lived up in Napa Valley at the time, 6 hours north. And as I'm driving back to LA, I was like thinking, I'm a terrible son. Like, when is it that a mom would offer to help on your move? Like, I called her up. I'm like, you need to be there. And she was like crying and super happy. And I'm so glad she was there, because people would come to her like with their problems, because it was very stressful. Rather than come to me and say, I hate you, they would go to my mom and tell my mom they hated me. And, no, they didn't hate me. We had a good time. But it was stress, because it was like, you know,
it was when a road movie.
When we weren't driving, we were filming. When we weren't filming, we were sleeping. We didn't sleep that much. So it was just everyone. I had an amazing cast and crew. We didn't have any problems, but you could just feel it. You felt the energy of like, everything had to be perfect on the road. If we had a pop tire or got in trouble or had an accident, it would have thrown everything off. And the fact that it didn't was incredible.
Well, you're also working together.
Yeah.
But then you're also living together.
Yeah.
So that's a different experience. I mean, usually you get to go home and have some peace
before
you separation. Come back to work.
That is true.
And you didn't have that.
No.
And
we didn't have any of that. We didn't even have a way to wash dishes. My mom and the makeup artist, Sasha Glasser, the costume designer, DDK, and the production designer, Leah Russell, would take all of the pots and pans into the bathtub of the motel, and they would wash it in their bathtub for us to eat off of the next day. I mean, we were as independent as possible. Yeah, it was a little gross, but they made sure they were clean, you know. So they wouldn't shower with the dishes.
All right, I can take a quick shower, bring some dishes in with me. There we go. So, of course, Zendog is about Mud, who lives in San Francisco, but is kind of just fearful of life. He's just kind of got this kind of very mundane, kind of repetitive life while he's trying to get his VR company off the ground.
Yes.
And then Dwayne comes in and says, you know what, I think I have something to kind of maybe expand your horizons a little bit. Mm-hmm. And introduces this, as you call it, this tea that takes him on the idea of lucid dreaming.
Yes.
And we see if Mud can actually change the way that he wants to live the rest of his life after going through this experience.
Mm-hmm.
So for you, because you said this is an idea that just kind of stuck with you. Was it Alan Watts that listening to him that kind of started germinating this idea? Was it something that you had independently and that just the two ideas kind of just synced up?
Yeah, it kind of was the second part. I knew of Alan Watts back when I was 18. I kind of was getting into books like The Cosmic Trigger by Robert Anton Wilson, who was a big kind of New Age thinker back in the 60s, 70s. And Tim Leary and Ginsberg, and Watts was part of that. And I always liked Watts's voice. I made like a student film when I went to USC that I used Watts's voice at the beginning of the film. And I always found him like, I just found his voice to be very cinematic. So it was always in the back of my head, but originally Watts wasn't intended to be in the film. I was having some relationship problems, and my girlfriend was driving me crazy at the time, and I was like, I don't know how to break up with her. I should drive to New York and flip a coin and just kill myself. And that was like I would never do that, but that was like a thought that popped in my head, like a dark thought. And then I went, I would never do that, but I would make a movie about that. So it kind of latched on. The original idea was so different than what it is now, but it got us going and it got the film moving. And I took a 10-day writing road trip. I knew I wanted to make a road film. I wanted to make a big, like, budget film about the L.A. bicycle scene, because I've been involved with that, and I thought it'd be a fascinating story, and I'm writing that now, and it's something I want to do and pursue, but I wanted to make something cheap, and I thought, what if we use America as a backdrop? Because every independent film, if you have a low budget, you typically want to shoot in one location and keep things cheap, and you're usually going with the horror genre, because you know you can sell that. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a formula that you can follow as a filmmaker if you want to break in quickly and you want to make something different. But, you know, we wanted to make a philosophical road story, so it's a little different market for that.
Because that's where the money is.
Yeah, the money's in philosophy, exactly. So I said, well, if I'm writing this, I should probably not write it in L.A. I should probably go on the road and travel. So I would drive for 6 hours, think about the story, then pull over at a motel and, like, write all night and then repeat, rinse and repeat. And after I had the first draft of the script, which, you know, was crap and needed work, as I was driving back to L.A., Alan Watts popped up on the car stereo randomly on my iPod. And I was looking at the landscape, desert landscape, and I was thinking about, like, you know, road trips traditionally use music to get the character from city to city. What if we used a philosopher's voice? So I, being the self-doubting person I am, I thought, well, I'll have to write that philosopher, because there's no way I can get Alan Watts. And I had a producer say, just reach out. And I reached out that night to the Alan Watts organization and told the random info@alanwatts.org email my plot of my story. And 45 minutes later, Alan Watts' son wrote me back and he said, you would not believe the synchronicity. I was working on a piece about suicide that my dad talked about, Alan Watts, and you wrote me this email, and I mentioned suicide in the email because the original idea was more rooted in that. And that was enough for him to pick up the phone and call me. And then at that moment, I got the title, came to me like a week later, and Mark Watts said, I'll give you the rights to all of the works. And then it just started. That's when the magic began. That's when, like, the movie started taking off. And my producer came to me, Richie, who shot the movie. And things just started happening, like people coming and wanting to work on it. And money started coming in. It was cool.
So this, of course, as you both are saying, a road trip movie.
Yeah.
Now, Adam, Kyle gets to go travel across the country.
Yeah.
You're just hanging out in San Francisco on this.
Well, it's actually L.A. Yeah, just a correction. In the dream state, when he comes out, that's San Francisco.
Okay.
But actually, the city's never labeled. But yeah, I think it is Los Angeles that he's in, like, the real world. So Adam's character, Dwayne, would be in L.A. Stupid correction.
Got it.
Sorry.
No. So for you, you don't get to go anywhere. Was that disappointing? Or you're like, no, that's cool because I can still just do my thing.
I was left home a lot. Growing up, so it just kind of, it didn't really bother me too much. I mean, I kind of used to it. I was kind of a latchkey kid growing up, so, you know, watched a lot of, like, People's Court and stuff, but, seeing those scenes when I got to see the movie, I was blown away, because, I mean, I know what I saw and what I was working on, and it was, like, some of the most beautiful, I mean, shot footage I've ever seen, and it was incredible, and just, I mean, just everything they got to do, I mean, seemed amazing. So, but I was cool with whatever, you know, Rick needed me to do. And I was okay with being, not having to, you know, go to Reno.
Like, you sure?
I mean, I don't know. Listen, I've never been, so I'm just kidding. But it was okay. It worked out. It worked out. So,
but yeah. And then at that point, when we went on the road, you were just under the impression that you would only be there for 3 days total of shooting.
Right.
He came up and he shot a little bit in San Francisco. Then he went back to L.A. while we went on the road. And then you came back and you did 2 days. And then we said, goodbye, that's a wrap on Adam.
Right.
And then we hit you up like 3 months later and said, oh, we wrote all this new stuff for you. Come back.
Yeah. So that was awesome. That part was awesome.
Yeah.
So it was great. I'm just, it's cool.
Well, let's talk about Dwayne for a moment.
Sure.
Because Dwayne comes rolling into Mud's life.
Right.
He's just visiting. He's on spring break. He decided to go back to school.
Right.
He's on spring break, just crashing. And Mud is very OCD. Wants everything clean, which I do like. You just come in and you just kind of make yourself at home.
Right.
But he's also practicing something called the polyphasic sleep cycle.
Right.
Which is like you sleep like 20 minutes every 2 hours.
Yes.
And it's supposed to be like a mental clarity, skin clears up.
So right.
Who has best skin? Me.
Right. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I guess I kind of heard a little bit about it, but I didn't really know much about the polyphasic sleep cycle. Is that, have either of you been tempted to actually try that in real life?
I think I do it accidentally, where I'll sleep for 20 minutes and I probably should, wherever I am, I shouldn't be sleeping. I don't know if you saw me like 10 minutes ago.
Yeah,
I was taking a quick little thing. But I'm not interested in doing that because I like sleeping for longer than 20 minutes, to be honest. So I think I do it. Like if I do it, it's accidental.
I've actually never experimented with it, and it's in the film, but I kind of want to try it now because I feel like I should be trying it at least for, you know, a couple days of some polyphasic sleep. Yeah.
I feel like the hardest thing is just the initial, like, getting yourself acclimated to it.
Yeah, to that
probably,
cycle.
That probably would suck.
Yeah,
but
probably
like, once
take
you got
a
into
bit.
It,
yeah.
Maybe.
I can
cool.
see. Yeah. I like it because it just shows that this, I don't know, it's just this weird quirk of this character. Like, he's into weird things. Like, he knows about lucid dreaming, and he knows about that LSD book, and he's just into these weird little, I don't know.
He doesn't come across like he would be into this stuff.
Yeah.
Which is what I think is so endearing about him. But yet, he's kind of like, he's cool. Like, he's kind of on the pulse of, like, some different stuff in a way, you know? And at first, I think you're a little confused. Like, what is this guy about? Like, what's going on? Like, is he dangerous? You know, like, a little bit. But then you kind of are like, wow, he's, you know, you realize, you know, as the movie goes on, that his relationship with his cousin is something that he really, you know, wants to, you know, make better and become closer with his cousin is cool.
Yeah. He's like this weird spiritual guru to me in the film. Like, there's one moment that I really like with you where Mud is like microwaving the tea and he's walking back to the bedroom and you're asleep with the mask on, but you're not. You're like checking him out, but you're not, you know, interfering with him or telling him he shouldn't be doing this. You're like observing him and watching him, you know, go on this path. And I don't know, I really like what his character turned into. And some of it was intentional, and other things were just like, that's just how it came out. You almost get to observe it after the fact and go like, oh yeah, there was all this dimension and like things that we, you know, weren't aware of when we came up with choices when we
yeah,
were, but
true.
Then they worked out, if that makes sense. I don't know. You like make a choice, and David Lynch talks about this because he does transcendental meditation, and he talks about when he was making the original Twin Peaks, there was a moment when they were setting up camera and the actors were getting set up. And he saw something like in the window that looked interesting, and he just rolled on it. Like, he didn't know why. He just rolled on it. And then in post, he found that part, and it worked because they needed this character to appear as a ghost, and they had to have this flashback moment, and he had the perfect little bit that worked. And he was just like, you know, just always be open when you're making things, and like, be, if you have a voice and it says grab it, do it, because you don't know. So we would do that with choices with his character. And just like the polyphasic thing was like a quirky decision, but it makes sense to me now that he would be into something like that when his cousin's into dreaming.
There are two things that I did enjoy. There's one where Mud comes into the room and you're laying on the couch and you get like a notepad or a book there and you just laugh. And he says, what? He's like, oh, I'm just homework.
Yeah.
That was just something that would just make you laugh just there by yourself, just doing some homework. Yeah,
right, which is so weird, because what homework makes you laugh?
Yeah, why is it? What problem are you looking at?
I was probably laughing because it was so difficult. I could never get it right.
The other choice was that you decide you're going to make Mud some eggs.
Yes.
And you give them to him. You and he both share them in these small bowls, and you're eating them with your hands.
Yeah.
But it's like these small little itty bitty bites that you're just putting into your mouth.
That's right.
They're just so tiny.
There were shells in those in the bowls. Yeah.
I just want to know what was going on in that scene when you're like, all right, we're going to film it like this, guys. And were there eggs? Were there real eggs?
Yeah, there were eggs. Why didn't we use forks?
I don't know the reason.
You know, it might have come down to a decision, like, as stupid as it sounds, like, there might not have been forks at that moment. Maybe. Yeah. And it was just like, oh, we don't have time. Put it in the bowl. Like, I feel like that's what it was. Like, because I don't think we, like, that wasn't a conscious decision.
And it just felt I had it. I should do something with it. Like, I always want to use what I have because I think it just enriches the moment. And but, you know, just naturally. Like, I didn't even realize I started eating it. I didn't realize I was eating it that much. And by the end, I was so full. And
Adam's really good at, he's an amazing improv, you know, actor. He's really good at, some actors aren't good with it. You'll be like, do this, and then come up with, and they just hit a wall. But Adam, like, thrives in that space. He's really good at, like, adding these little one-liners and moments and things. And I love that, like, as a director, to be able to, like, do what we have on the script and then get rid of it and see what feels more natural to you. And he's has always been incredible at just making it his own, and like in his own way.
Yeah.
And yeah, that probably is where it came from. You probably just did it yourself, and it was just like, well, that's funny. Like, go with that.
Yeah, and I always find that the stuff that's really, really funny is the stuff that's not usually on the page.
Yeah, you don't plan.
You know, I mean, it could be the funniest script in the world, but the moments where you just, it's just a look or just a moment or an exchange between two people and there's nothing going on,
mm-hmm.
that's the part that makes things really rich and believable. And so it's not just funny or just, you know, info. I think it's just, building that world around it and getting to play in between in the script that's not there.
Yeah. There is just the process of making this tea. There's just something about just the ritualistic nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
You put the leaves in and then the water and then you press it on, which I thought, I'm not really into the teas or anything like that, but it's just a cool contraption.
Yeah,
I'm
sure that's fun.
That where it just, you just let it on top and then it just drains through?
It has a little stopper and then you can buy them on Amazon and anywhere. I keep plugging Amazon. Well, they are going to be selling the Blu-ray very soon, so I got to plug them. But it's a little stopper and it lets it steep and then go through. I liked it because it was just a cool visual rather than a tea bag.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, it was going to be a pill. It was going to be like a dream pill. But I was there's something cool about the tea, something organic about, I don't know, it coming from the earth and not from a pharmaceutical company, a fictitious pharmaceutical company in the film. So I like that. I like that it's like an organic thing. And it's also like a weird, maybe homage to the ayahuasca, you know, psychedelic that a lot of people have
and
been.
And visually it's so cool.
Yeah.
And it's
visually
cool.
It's fun. But people always think it's like cigarette butts in the close-up. Like when you go, yeah, but it's like that, actually, that tea that you see. No, it's a type of root. I forget what kind. That tea that we made, it's I don't know the names because they're in Latin. There's science, but there are three dream teas that you can take that will help you induce lucidity while you're dreaming. So we remained authentic to that. It's not a white tea though. It's a very green brown tea. Kyle wasn't drinking caffeine at the time. And I didn't want to deal with this caffeine issue. So I just said, vitamin water, make it white. So it's like white vitamin water that we color shifted in post. And that's what he's drinking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because I was also wondering, like,
it's one thing to get vitamin water on Amazon.
Yeah, we got vitamin water on Amazon and get a whole case of it.
It's one thing when you're having to eat throughout a scene. If you have to do pickups or other takes, you got to keep eating. You got to keep continuity.
That's why no one ever eats in movies.
That's right.
They just always have the fork.
Unless it's eggs with your fingers.
Yeah. That's right.
Then you have
tiny bites, though. For continuity.
Which is like you were putting in like it was like chaw.
Yeah.
Right in the center. Like a bird. Like that. Yep. But what's it like when, because that's a huge glass. Kyle's got to drink several times through the course of the film. It's
a lot of pee.
By the end of it, he's like, do I have to keep drinking?
A lot of pee breaks. he was always a trooper. Kyle was cool about everything, anything we wanted to do. I remember he said that he just didn't. He would have drank the tea with caffeine if we wanted him. We would have figured out a way to dilute it or not even have caffeine in there. Yeah. But it was just like a simple solution of like, oh, this is more magical, looks a little more interesting. But yeah, I don't think we did too many takes of the drinking. It was more like those were one or two takes of just like we got it. You know, it was more performance of like when we did more. Yeah, because we didn't want to like push them. You do as a filmmaker sometimes like. You'll get that you do the minutia type of filmmaking, like things like that, where an actor isn't doing dialogue and they're drinking or they're grabbing a cup, and you tend to spend so much time with those shots for some reason. I don't know why. What is it about these technical stupid shots where you're like, it's just like focus more on the performance and like you know what the story's about. But for those things, I think it was quick because we were aware that he had a. Yeah, it's got a bladder.
Now, the vehicle that Kyle uses, once he enters into these lucid dreams, the idea is that he takes a road trip while he's lucid dreaming. And this vehicle, you mentioned you bring it up with you from Los Angeles.
Yes.
This paint job on there, did you find it with that paint job intact, or did you do this paint job?
Yeah, everything was custom. So when we bought the Squareback, we bought it off of a soon-to-be dad. His wife was about to have a kid, and she wanted him to get rid of his Squareback because he was going to buy a minivan. So I caught him on Craigslist, and we offered him some money for the car, and it ran well. It was a 1969 Volkswagen, pale blue Squareback, and I knew that it was... In the original script, the characters were going to paint it. Like, Mud and Maya were going to paint it themselves, and I was like, I don't want to film that scene. It's a nightmare. Let's have it pre-painted. And he finds it that way. So we hired this artist, a team of artists that worked with our production designers, and they came up with my help, and it was all collaboration. We came up with the outside design based on, you know, inspiration from 60s psychedelic, you know, culture. We even got inspiration from old designs that were on acid tablets back in the day, things of that nature. The original older backstory of the film was that this car belonged to a Merry Prankster, and the Pranksters were a group of psychedelics led by Ken Kesey that went cross country in the 60s, giving out to acid to strangers, and while it would, you know, when it used to be legal. And there was a book about it called The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which is an amazing book about that whole experience. But yeah, we painted that thing, and then we interior designed the whole thing with AstroTurf on the ceilings, and we decked it all out, and it was fun. It took about a month to kind of get that car to the state that you see it in the film.
Now, you mentioned the people traveling around, handing out LSD and whatnot. There's a sequence in the film, it is a trip within a trip,
mm-hmm.
because it is a mud lucid dreaming, but then all of a sudden, in that lucid dream, he's given LSD.
Yes.
And then you watch things go bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
What was the idea of, I guess having a trip inside a lucid dream?
Right. Yeah. I love drug sequences in movies. I think it's always interesting how filmmakers like portray drugs. Like there's that movie Go, which Doug Liman made, which he, you know, portrays ecstasy by shooting things really quickly. And it's like, it's fun to see films that do drug sequences correctly. Gaspar Noé did Enter the Void, and he shows what the effects of DMT, and it's super accurate from what I've heard. I don't know what DMT is, but
Adam.
But I always wanted to make like a really like awesome LSD scene. I just wanted to put that down, like, and put it out there of like, I wanted to make, like, you know, the best LSD scene in a film. And I loved in Easy Rider their LSD sequence, although it's very dated and they do a lot of stuff with editing, but I like how they use editing to create this effect, this feeling. I didn't want to do anything CGI or anything, so we did all of our effects in this LSD sequence are kind of homage to the 60s of layering images on top of each other and just playing with simple layering effects rather than computer-generated animation or things like that. But the idea was to just do this culminating moment in the film where everything, all of Watts' teachings, all of Mudd's feelings about himself and his life on the road kind of culminate into this big thing. What I like about this moment is Watts is talking to Mudd, but he's also talking to like the audience as well. He's encouraging the audience to close their eyes and learn how to meditate while in the theater you have his voice flying all around you in 5.1 surround. So there's like this line of like Watts is here to speaking to us, the people watching it, and also speaking to the character. And that moment to me like crosses all those boundaries, and it's fun. I enjoyed it.
Now, one thing we also have too is at the beginning of the film, kind of the dream that has been plaguing Mudd for the longest time. It's this recurring dream about something that happens in a workplace where he imagines himself to be in this dream. But you have Clea DuVall sitting there as the boss.
Yeah.
Very quick, but she's always fun to watch. How did you end up scoring her for just for a couple days on the film?
She was, like I said earlier, before directing, had a background in cinematography and editing as well. And I did several music videos for Warner Brothers, doing like different artists underneath their label, shooting for these different directors. Clea DuVall wanted to direct a music video. So she went to Warner and she said, I want to do something. And they said, oh, we have this band, Dale Earnhardt Jr. And she's like, cool, I'll do that song. And they reached out to me and I got in touch with her. We did the shoot. It never got finished. We went into production, we did the edit, but the band and the label ended up going with something else. That happens sometimes. She came to my office and we were looking at dailies, and I brought up Zendog and I said, we're still looking for our lead character. And she says, I know somebody, this my friend Eldon Henson, I think he could be good for your film. And she made a comment, she's like, I'm upset you didn't ask me to be in your movie. And I'm like, oh, that's funny, because I need a part filled and you'd be perfect. She admitted later, like after we got her on the BTS, that she was just saying that. She wasn't like, think I would really pursue her. But I immediately like got in touch with her people and like roped her in. So I played into her guilt and made sure she followed through on her word. And she did.
There you go. I mean, don't say those things because you could get called on it.
Oh, yeah. Like if someone says they're going to do something for me, I'm like, okay, let's do this. And like, you better do it now. But I try to do the same for other people. Like, you know, you got to be true to your word and stick to that.
Getting back to that loyalty thing we're talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's important.
Not, yeah.
Exactly. So through various different cities. Now, at the beginning, you were kind of mentioning that a couple days into the filming, you're sitting there in Reno. Things start kind of going crazy with the crew. It's kind of realizing the task that lies ahead for them.
Yeah.
When it kind of gets to that low point there, what do you do to make sure? I mean, because everybody's looking to you as a captain of the ship.
Yeah.
How much of a challenge was that for you to like, all right, I've got to course correct and get everybody in the right mindset and everything around that all set up so we can keep making this film?
Yeah. Those decisions usually come really quickly because you go, okay, look, I've got my my production coordinator threatening to quit, saying we need to rent another vehicle to make runs for coffee because we can't keep using the same truck that's towing the square back. You know, that's all we had. It was very difficult, and saying we needed another person. So I remember it was just in Reno, it was a quick decision of we had to fire someone. We had to hire a new person. We had to get a car and we had to get a PA out there in a matter of 12 hours. And it's just crazy. It just worked. It like things just is another thing. Like it just make the decision. And
but that's
then
why there's Amazon.
That's why there's Amazon. Right. Yeah, there was just it wasn't like when those things happen and you feel like it's about to go down the toilet, you just have to act quickly and you know what you need to do and you just make calls and hope that the other person picks up on the other end. And luckily we had a lot of support in LA and we were able to get the things we needed. And then once we left Reno, things were very difficult, but we were a family at that point. We were a team.
None of those calls went to Adam, though. Adam, we need you out here.
Just well, we need it. It was more if Adam was like, you know, he did crew or he was we would be calling him, but we wanted to save Adam's acting talents. But yeah, we needed like we basically needed like another body. We needed someone competent to work with camera and we needed another vehicle. And then once we got those things, we were good to go. And we got them within 12 hours of requesting them. And because we were in Reno when the ship was about to go down and it was enough time and we were close enough to still bring people up from LA.
And so. I'm probably not the first phone call to get all that done.
No.
I don't think so.
Where do you rank on the list? Third, fourth?
I think top four or five.
Top four. Top four list.
Yeah.
So doing a road trip movie, is that, which is harder? Just doing a road trip where you're with various friends and family and all the headaches that can be involved with that? Or when you're doing an actual film about a road trip? Is that even more challenging?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the most challenging. A road trip is fun. You know, you get to go, pull over, eat food, sleep in. A film on the road with a crew and moving parts.
Would you do it again?
No. No way. Like, do it the same way?
Yeah.
No. That was like, this is a once in a lifetime movie for me. Like, I don't want to make a movie this way. It was great. But like, it was, you have to have a bit naive going into it. And you have to be really optimistic and being like, it's going to happen. Because if you have any shred of doubt or any kind of fear, it would have never gotten. If I knew what it took, I don't know if I could have done it. Like, once I was in it, I had no choice. I was in it.
This sounds like that naivete was your biggest asset.
Yeah, exactly. Because that allowed me to, like, get everyone else's energy up and moving and, like, keep people focused. But it was difficult because it was, you know, every time we would pull over and want to do a shot, even at a location, it would take an hour and a half to 2 hours before we were rolling. Because you have to physically get gear off the camera, you know, off the bus. You have to unload it. It just takes time. It's a lot of... That's why movie sets, they have so many people because you're reducing time. You have one person doing one very specific job. And often on indie sets, you have one person doing three or four different jobs at a time. So, you know.
So for anybody that was watching this film on Blu-ray where they have all the other, the 27-minute documentary.
Oh, yeah, the special features, yeah.
One, they want to get involved and like, you know, I've got a road trip movie that's just kind of burning a hole in my head that I got to get out. What is just one bit of advice, even though naivete is a great asset, but what's just one bit of advice you would give somebody that they wanted to do their own road trip movie? Like, for the love of God, make sure you do this.
Make sure you surround yourself with people that are as passionate and most importantly believe in you and like that support you. That's the most important thing. Other than that, you know, just do it and get out there. But I think it's really important, like who is near you and who you have that are with you and collaborating with you. Because you need to make sure those people are love you and are excited about it. They can be stressed out, but they have to want to be there. Yeah, toxic personalities don't work on set. So make sure that you know your people before you go. Luckily for us, we had amazing people. But I could see if we had something, if we had a bad person out there, it would have been tough, because then you gotta kill him. You gotta leave him on the side of the road. What else are you gonna do?
That's right.
I don't know.
There's not a lot of choices on the road. Yeah.
So make sure you got good people that you know you want to take out to dinner.
And if you're gonna visit a relative, just make sure that.
Well, you don't do that.
No, don't visit a relative.
Don't ever.
Unless
don't
post on social media. Unless you want your movie to go to hell. And your personal life.
All right. So now the film came out on the 22nd on Blu-ray, video on demand, all digital release platforms.
Yes. Yes. So iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, Vudu, PSN, Xbox, Fandango Now, and Steam for right now. And then we'll expand to Hulu, Netflix, hopefully by the end of the year. But yeah, you can see it. It's alive. You can rent it. You can buy it. You can own it on Blu-ray.
If everybody watching or listening to this wants to kind of follow up on what's happening with Zendog at the moment.
Oh, yeah. So the best way to do it is to our social media. You can go to zendogmovie.com. You can follow us on Facebook, which is facebook.com/zendogmovie. You can go to our Instagram, which is zendogmovie. Very easy. So zendogmovie on all the – and Twitter as well. But we're the most active on Instagram and Facebook in terms of updates and all that good stuff. So.
And Adam, if they wanted to try to get you on their project for nothing, the best place
10%
to reach you?
10%. I get 10% of nothing.
Just DM me at Adam Hirschman on was it Twitter?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I guess that's a thing now. Is that people on that?
People
on Twitter. Just DM me. Let me know what you got going on. And who knows? I'm like Bill Murray. Just let me know.
Yeah, he's got a 1-800 number.
I got a 1-800 number, and I don't have an agent. So great.
Look at that. All right, ladies and gentlemen, my guests have been Adam Hirschman and Rick Darsh. Make sure you check out Zendog. It's an awesome movie. Check it out everywhere that they said. It's well worth your time. Ladies and gentlemen, I've been your host, Frank Moran. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at HappyGoJackie. We'll be back with another episode of I Talk Movies soon. Take care.
Thanks, Frank.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.